Welcome. Here we are again with risk analyst Gordon Phillips, and today we take a peek into Gordon's daily routine. For the past 30 years, Gordon has practiced one of the most healthy daily living habits. Each day he spends 90 minutes reading, and he's now amassed a personal library of 5,000 books. And Gordon, how did this get started? When did your nonstop desire for knowledge actually begin?
Well, would I be exaggerating if I said 2 years old?
Really?
I was always a very, very curious child. I drove everyone around me crazy. Well, why? 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 Well, how come? I don't understand. Why? Just my parents in those days, of course, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Everyone had an encyclopedia in their home because there was no internet. There was the Encyclopedia Britannica, there was the Grolier Encyclopedia, the World Book Encyclopedia, right? And I can remember spending hours just sitting, paging through that thing, just going from one page to the next, just amazed at all the things that there were in the world to know. And that maybe that made me a nerd before the word nerd had been invented. But I've always been curious, very curious, and eclectically curious. And as I got older, it turned more towards wanting to know how things really work. My passion as I got into my early 40s was, I'm living through history right now, and I don't understand it. In other words, 500 years from now, this era will be but a footnote in the history book of the future. And it'll be very clear, oh, this is what happened, and this guy did that to them, and then these people did that, and this happened. But I could see things going really south, going in the wrong direction, even as a young guy. And losing freedoms, it was really clear to me. And I just couldn't understand why it was happening. Like, why don't the people, why aren't they aware? Why isn't everyone waking up? Why isn't this on TV? How can they get away with it? I can't believe they can get away with this. And I started spending more and more time digging in and trying to understand, the way I express it, is the history that I've lived through. And that, of course, led to a tremendous passion for reading, because literally everything you need to, just about, everything you need to know is in a book. You just need to know which book and read it.
Well, okay. So is it safe to assume that you've always been pretty much a nonfiction reader for most of your life?
Well, actually, in my early teens, I was crazy about science fiction. I would read a book a day. I just absolutely loved science fiction. Most of what I read is nonfiction.
What was the one book, the one topic, the one book that really helped you catch fire? What was that turning point in your curiosity?
Well, I don't mean this to sound like I'm avoiding or answering your question, but the books that I have read that totally changed my life, I wouldn't even want to go into here on a recording, because they're so shocking and so contrary to popular assumed opinion, that they almost characterize you as something that you're not. I guess to keep it as general as I can, one of the most interesting books I ever read was the Internal Revenue Code. So back in late 1980s, early 1990s, I was aware that several Internal Revenue Service agents around the country were going over the fence. They were leaving the agency. Today we would call them whistleblowers. And they were exposing what they said was the complete utter fraud regarding the collection of the income tax. And because they were former agents, naturally, you give them a lot of credence. They had a lot of credibility. And they were in the process of being viciously attacked by the very service that they had just resigned from, which also makes perfect sense, which we know, because if the IRS can be weaponized against the American people, imagine what they'll try to do to one of their own when they try to go over the wall and spill the beans, so to speak. So I decided that I would find out for myself. So I read the entire code. It's 9,600 pages. Now, I didn't drop everything and just read that, but I would read it for half hour, 45 minutes a day. It took me over a year. It's written in tissue-thin paper, and I think something like an 8 or a 9-point font. It's the most difficult thing to read. It's the driest possible thing you can imagine. But I did discover for myself what the liability actually is for the income tax, employment tax, excise tax, inheritance taxes, who it's imposed upon, under what conditions you have to be involved, what time, you know, who, what, where, when, and why, who's the subject of the law, where do you have to be on earth, and what do you have to be doing, and who do you have to be doing it with so that you come under that statute, and then what are the reporting requirements, and what are the paying requirements, then what are the penalties for failure to do these things. And I actually learned about the whole thing for myself. And it was a huge eye-opener. It was literally like stepping into another world. So there are books like that that are life-transforming.
How much can you learn about a book before actually buying it? What is your criteria? How do you make that judgment?
Well, in the past, it was simply word of mouth or referral or somebody recommended a good book. I mean, today it's easy to go on Amazon, for example. If I'm interested in something I think I might like to read, I'll just take a quick look at reviews, testimonials. And I look at the top ones and I look at the bottom ones. And you can read 10 or 20 and get a really good sense of how other thoughtful people, a well-written testimonial, it really goes into some detail and expresses the appreciation of what they took away from the book, for example. As a case in point, I was telling my children a year ago about the book Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, which is the only book I ever read twice in the same day. I was starting out as a young musician, totally broke. I was living in a room in a boarding house, like literally making enough money to live day to day. And a friend of mine lent me the book and said it was incredible. And I did. I read it. I read it till around 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was so moved by that book, just so totally blown away, to use the term, that I didn't exactly reread it word for word, but I reread huge passages of it by the time the sun came up. Now, today, if you go on Amazon and you go to Catch 22 by Joseph Heller and you look at the reviews, some of the reviews are stunning. People will write, say, this book moved me as much as any book I ever read in my entire life. And I've actually made it a point to reread it every decade of my life. I mean, there are some reviews on there that actually say things like that. And so, you know, if you get those kind of reviews about a book that you're thinking of reading, well, obviously it lends a lot of credence. I have a huge list that in front of me of books I intend to read. And then when I go to pick the next one, I'll take a quick look at my notes and I think I'll read this one next, you know. I guess we each have our own criteria. How we do that?
How much emphasis do you place on an author's credentials?
Well, there are two different ways to look at that. You know, if I'm focused on who the person was, that might bias and prejudice me in advance, pro or con, for or against what they have to say. So if you hand me a book and I don't know who wrote it, it would be like a dog walking up to you with a CD in its mouth, right? You don't know the dog's name. You don't know where he got the CD. You pop it in your computer. Not that we use CDs anymore, but you get my point. You pop it in your computer and you start reading it. And immediately you're gripped by the narrative, by the tone of writing, by the author's self-confidence, by the way the book draws you in. Maybe you glance through the table of contents and you go, whoa, I'm in for a ride with this one. I don't believe what this book's going to cover. I can't wait to read it. You know, that's more important to me than who the person is. Not that I ignore that, but it's interesting to me to find out more about the author after I've absorbed a body of their works, because then it even gives more value to what they wrote.
Is there a wrong way to read a book? There is a book that has been written titled How to Read a Book. And so I remember that. And
well, there are some people who advocate, you know, read the table of contents first, go through, skim each chapter, get a sense of where the book's going to go in advance, go to the very end, you know, find out how the killer, you know, pulled it off and got away, and then go back and read the book. I personally tend not to do that. If it's a book that's nonfiction, it's going to be very dense and dry, a lot of historical information. Yes, I will scan the table of contents. I might jump just to a chapter that I'm particularly intrigued about. But for the most part, I just read the book from beginning to end.
How often are you disappointed in a book?
Very seldom, because if I get, you know, more than 30 or 40 or 50 pages in it, I'm not getting anything out of it, I'll stop. And then reevaluate, why am I reading this? And then maybe I'll jump to one of those websites where it gives you like the Cliff's Notes, you know, the summary of the book, or basically to a review where it says, spoiler, here's what this book was about. And that doesn't happen very often. I try to be selective and discriminating enough about what I do want to read that I'm not disappointed. I think it's quite common that many authors really have one great idea, and then they write that great idea, and then they repeat that great idea with different flavoring. And from different perspectives over the next two or three books. So I don't necessarily read, just because an author wrote a great book doesn't mean I'll automatically read the next one and the next one that they come out with, because they have to make a living. And, you know, a lot of times you can tell on the first book, the title is huge and their name is small. The next book, their name is huge and the title is small. And that's the publishing company making sure that they try to promote sales. So,
well, what are you reading right now and why?
Right now I'm reading 1 Second After. It actually is a fictional novel, although it's so realistic that it could literally be tomorrow's history. It's all about what happens in America when the power grid goes down and doesn't come back up again, when the internet goes down and doesn't come back up again, and how life begins to deteriorate day by day and society just goes completely out of control, and how this family copes with it. Very informative for preppers, put it that way.
I believe you told me you spend 90 minutes a day reading. Is that still correct?
Yeah, pretty much. Some day a little less, some days a little bit more. But to me, I have a whole routine I do in the morning.
Yeah.
I exercise, I use wellness therapies, I meditate, I do deep breathing techniques. Of course, I catch up on my email. I read and take notes, and I take notes on things that I'm writing and take notes on, you know, subject matter for future podcasts, things like that. It's rare that I don't put at least an hour in a given day.
Okay, so you basically prioritize reading right up there with your other activities, correct, every day?
Oh, absolutely. It's homeschool. I tell my kids I'm in the 69th grade. Okay, I've never stopped educating myself my entire life. I mean, I couldn't live long enough to read the things I'm interested in. I got on a kick around 10 years ago when I started learning about energy medicine, and then I got into the history of energy medicine, and then I got into the history of human civilization, the true history of human civilization. And it's nothing like I ever dreamed it is. The amount of information, you want to talk about a rabbit hole, the amount of information you can go down learning about, like, for example, the megalithic blocks all over the world, continents everywhere. There are huge stones, part of construction of temples and monuments, and of course the pyramids in Egypt. There's pyramids all over the world, which most people don't know. The largest pyramid in the world is in Bosnia. Some of these stones weigh 1,500 tons. There isn't a crane on the planet that can lift them. And they're placed together with such perfection, you can't slip a credit card between them with no mortar. And they're up 30 feet, one stacked on top of the other one, 30 feet up in the air. And all modern engineers, the kind of people who work for Bechtel and these huge corporations, the kinds that do major hydroelectric projects and oil refineries, the largest manufacturing firms in the world, they'll look at this and they're looking right at it. They say, I don't know. I don't know how they did that. I have no idea how they did that. It's right in front of me. I can walk up. I can rub my hand down the face of it. I'm looking right at it and I have no idea how they did it. Well, it's very clear to me, just using deductive reasoning, that it was done through a whole form of energy that we don't have experience with today, which would be vibrational energy, sound energy, actually the ability to modify matter and be able to control it in a way that we don't have that technology today. So once you start to go down those kinds of trails, you just read one book after another. Like there's a book I read last month called The Giants Who Ruled America. In the mid-1800s, late 1800s, and even up until the early 1900s, and this is prior to radio and TV and modern electronics, this was all reported in newspapers of the day. There were countless reports of people mostly settling the West, where new areas had been being explored and panned for gold and being dug that had never been explored before. And they would find skeletons, perfectly normally developed human skeletons, where the thigh bone was as long as your leg. People who were 12 feet tall, 15 feet tall, with reddish hair. Hundreds of examples of them, all documented. And you can actually, there are newspaper services. You can sign up for newspaper research services, where you can go back and you can look up stories from newspapers 100 years ago, and you can find these articles yourself if you know what search terms to use, because their language, the way they would write and the kind of words they would put into a headline were a little stilted and different than we would do today. So you have to know a little bit about how to do the research that's era appropriate, but they're all over the place. All of those remains disappeared. They all went into back rooms in museums, the Smithsonian, and all over the place, and they're totally denied by museum creators to this day. Now, you can either think that that's a hoax, that it's another Bigfoot story, that it's just completely crazy, but there's so much forensic and scientific evidence for its veracity that it's really undeniable, combined with the fact that there are cultures and legends and stories all over the world of the same experience. So somewhere in human history's very, very, very ancient past, it appears that there was a version of Homo whatever, giganticus, I don't know what we would call it, that existed on this planet. And why are they not around anymore? Where'd they go? So that takes you into the subject of catastrophism. And it starts to teach you why there are so many different types of humans walking around today, and then gets you into forecasting when the next major shift, I'll just put it that way, will come. So when you, if you really enjoy learning and you have a curious, open mind, and you get off onto a subject like that, you just, it's like drinking from a fire hose. You just, I mean, I wish I could read, I wish I had more time to read or go to lectures or go to retreats or seminars, or, you know, I do as much as I can as it is with a busy life, but.
Okay, I've enjoyed this immensely. Why don't you tell us a couple more stories to wrap it up?
Well, I think to take a broader, higher level view of it, reading a book is having a conversation with the author. It's a one-way conversation. But a book like The Politics of Obedience by Étienne de la Boétie, where he questions why it is that humans support with their love, their labor, their taxes, and even their children to serve in the armies of the very tyrants who oppress them. Why would anybody in their right mind do that? That question was asked over 400 years ago. So that book, that young man, 22-year-old French seminary student who wrote that book, is still talking to me right now, today. Thomas Paine, the great firebrand who almost single-handedly, along with Samuel Adams, lit the match that turned into the American Revolution, who wrote The American Crisis and who wrote Common Sense. He wrote a book called The Age of Reason, and he wrote it in a French prison in the middle of the French Revolution, which he went there to support after the American Revolution. And he was in fear of his life, that he expected to be executed literally at the guillotine any day. Just try to put yourself in the frame of mind of being all alone, in terror for your life, in a French prison, 6,000 miles away from home, and you write a book. And the book was The Age of Reason. And it's one of the most powerful books I have ever read in my life. And so here is this man reaching out to anyone who wants to read that book and have a conversation. Again, albeit a one-sided conversation. So a book well-written that expresses value has so much value, and can have so much value to so many people who come even hundreds of years later. And I think that's a very, very powerful thing. And I think that literacy is extremely important. I think we're losing it. We live mostly in what I call a tribal culture today, where most homes that I visit these days, and of course, I'm too polite to ever to say this, but you just quietly make note, very few homes have any books in them. It's really kind of sad. We've reverted to a culture of storytelling. It's either in podcasts like we're doing right now, or it's the audio track of a video. You can't read a book and jog at the same time. You can't read a book and drive a car at the same time. You can't read a book and do lots of things. You have to stop the world and sit down and pick it up and engage with the book in real time. You don't have to do that with auditory media. You don't really have to give it your full attention. You can kind of listen, maybe listen to it again. And a book really commands your, as I say, commands your attention, commands your awareness. So that's my takeaway.
Okay, and there you have it. Thank you, Gordon.